View Network Studios.
It's a busy Wednesday here on the Brad Sesmatt Show. Jordan Hamm filling in for the big guy. We got U.S. Women's National Team. Were they crossing a line with their celebrations and their dominating performance in their opener for the World Cup? We got Diamondbacks. We got Suns. A lot to get to. And excited to talk to some people here on this very show. Garrett Cleverly from the Arizona Soccer Association. He's going to talk some World Cup with us here at 10:20. And then Jonah Carey of The Athletic, one of the best baseball minds out there, in my opinion. He has the Opener podcast, does the 30, which power ranks all MLB teams on The Athletic. Has been around, been everywhere, one of the best writers and podcasters out there, in my opinion, when it comes to baseball. So he's going to join us at 11 to talk about the Diamondbacks and kind of the NL West as a whole, because I feel like it's a very interesting time right now. You have the Dodgers kind of running away with the division right now, but you have three teams clumped together within striking distance of the wild card: the Diamondbacks, the Padres, the Rockies, and even the Giants hanging around a little bit. So I want to talk to him about where the NL West is, where it could be a couple weeks from now with the trade deadline, and where it could be a couple years from now, because I feel like there are a couple of teams and franchises that are setting themselves up quite nicely to make a couple of runs here in the next couple of years. So all that and more, we're going to get things going here with the rundown brought to you by Sagicor Now. Sagicor Now, protect what matters most. So let's kick things off with the World Cup and the U.S. Women's National Team. They played Thailand, won 13-0. They missed the extra point. The biggest margin of victory in the World Cup, just a dominating performance across the board. And people were starting to say they were running up the score. They were being kind of classless. They were flexing their muscles on a team that has never been to the World Cup. And my response to that is, one, I think one of the bigger things here is goal differential is one of the tiebreakers. So put 30 on them if you can. If you're a team and you feel like you can continue to push that, and look, Thailand, yes, they're new. It's a hell of a hello to the Women's World Cup that you get 13 dropped on you and just absolutely dominated. I even saw there were shots of children crying in the stands and all the dramatics that came with it. But the other two teams in your group are also going to play Thailand. So you need to set yourselves up. This is the pinnacle of women's soccer, the Women's World Cup. This is the absolute pinnacle of that. So you need to put up as many goals as you can. So with that, I'm fine with. There are a lot of celebrations that were happening, a lot of creative celebrations that were going on. And I think with that, especially when you're getting to goal 8, goal 9, goal 10, goal 11. Every time I looked up, it felt like there was another goal being scored. And I'll admit, I was feeling a little conflicted at the time, saying, should they ease off? What's going on? Are we going to be looked at like the bad guys in D2 Mighty Ducks? Are we going to be Iceland, the team that just beats up on everybody and nobody really likes? And, the coach has greasy hair and it's just all a bad thing. But then the more and more I thought about it, because of that goal differential, that number wasn't as bad. Then I started thinking about the celebrations, maybe a little over the top. But here's the thing about this team. Since the last World Cup, they've been told they are the best team in the world, and they need to repeat because they were returning a lot of those same players to go ahead and do that. And they have been one of the most outspoken groups trying to get U.S. women's soccer as a whole on the map. And for them to have a dominating performance, they're showing what this sport can do. Yes, there's a huge differential. Right now, they're at the top in terms of resources, in terms of the notoriety and all of that. There's a long way to go when you go down all the way to Thailand with soccer and the resources that they have. But when you look at it compared to the men, which has underachieved compared to the women's national team especially, I have no issue with the women celebrating. Because, again, biggest event they can play in. For some of these players that scored their first goal in the World Cup, maybe their only World Cup, the only time they're going to get there, you don't know what's going to happen 4 years from now. You just don't. You don't know in the future if you're going to get to another one. So live it up. And what they're playing for is so much more than just a trophy right now. They're in the offseason. They've spent so much. Some of these players have spent so much time of their offseason fighting for to get equal pay. And there are some staggering numbers. I was reading a New York Times article and an article from The Ringer last night as I was looking over just where women's soccer as a whole is at. And in this New York Times article, Team USA, they members of them, put out a lawsuit trying to get equal pay for their male counterparts. And the men's team has been outspoken that they deserve that as well, that the women deserve the equal pay. When you look at this, it says the lawsuit asserts, for example, that from 2013 to 2016, if a male and a female national team player each played 20 exhibition games in a year, members of the men's squad would have earned an average of $263,320, while members of the women's squad would have earned a maximum of $99,000. Now, usually when there's an argument, NBA, WNBA, should they get paid more, that sort of thing, one of the first arguments against it is, well, there's not as much of a market, it doesn't make as much money, that sort of thing. The thing is, according to a complaint that was noted in 2016 to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the women brought in nearly $20 million more. They're making more money. They are dominating the competition. And yet they are making less than half of their male counterparts. When you look at Major League Soccer and the Women's Major League Soccer, I know the Women's Major League Soccer is still trying to get up and running, but the league minimum for Major League Soccer for the men, $50,000 a year. Okay? We're not talking about, with the NFL, with the NBA, where these are six-figure deals for the league minimum, and the deals are astronomical. That's not a outrageous amount of money for the league minimum for the men. For the women, it's $16,000. You can't live on that. And that's not outrageous to make that bump. And it actually took Lunabar to give them an endorsement to help close that gap entering the Women's World Cup. But why is that necessary? So when people are saying that they should, these players, they're scoring the goals, they're achieving the best thing they can at the highest pinnacle, and they're not getting paid what they should, have a freaking tea party on the field if you score a goal. I don't care if it's 11-0. I don't care if it's 1-0. Do your choreography. Do whatever you want. Because you are reaching something very few have done. And you're fighting for so much more than just what's on the field. Because if they do come out and they drop the ball and they don't play well, they come back to those lawsuits trying to fight for more equal pay, I'm sure there will be people that will say, well, there's a clear discrepancy between the quality of play and, you guys aren't quite reaching up to snuff and everything like that. Go ahead and dominate. Flex your muscle, show what you can do, show what the pinnacle of this sport and the pinnacle of a team effort can be within this sport to show the absolute best and prove that this is definitely deserved, because it is. It is absolute bullcrap that Lunabar had to come in to close that wage gap and not meet it, just make it a little bit closer. So that is one of the big storylines going around right now are the Americans doing too much when they score? You had a record-setting performance. Do whatever you want. With the NBA right now, obviously all eyes are on the finals. We head to Game 6 in Oakland, Warriors, Raptors. Warriors pulled out an impressive late game heroics from Clay, from Steph. But Kevin Durant, Should he have played? Should he not have? We're going to get to that at the 10:35 hour. Coming up next, we have Garrett Cleverly of the Arizona Soccer Association. We're going to be talking a little bit more about the Women's World Cup and some Arizona ties to it, because there are two pretty significant Arizona ties that I think are pretty cool. So we're going to discuss that next on the Brad Sussmat Show. Welcome back to the Brad Sussmat Show. Jordan Hamm filling in for Mr. Sussmat. On the phone right now, we have Garrett Cleverly of the Arizona Soccer Association, continuing our discussion on the Women's World Cup. Garrett, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Jordan. Appreciate it.
So Team USA had a, let's call it a solid performance in yesterday's opener against Thailand. Just what was your initial reaction to that 13-0 win?
Well, you knew the USA was going to go out there and smash Thailand. I mean, last time they played them was about a year and a half ago. They defeated them 9-0 there. So, you know, maybe you're not thinking 9 goals or even close to 13 goals, but, you know, the U.S. women went out and you know, they took care of business and they showed everyone that you know, the USA is the favorite for a reason, right? I mean, the USA is going to this World Cup looking to repeat, won 2015, winning their fourth overall title, and you know, scoring 13 goals in the opening match is a great start for the team, and you know, it's great for Alex Morgan scoring 5 goals, and it's just good for the whole team, right? I mean, lots of positive vibes going forward for the team.
So, what statement did the U.S. make to the rest of the field with that 13-goal win?
You know, I don't know, because I think that the biggest thing on the women's side is you have your elite teams, right? You have the U.S., France, Brazil, you know, Sweden, Germany, Canada. You throw England in there as well. You know, you kind of like your top-tier teams, maybe your top-10 teams. Then after that, you know, it's kind of a mix of teams, and then you open up to another range of teams that Thailand applies to. I mean, they've opened up the World Cup. This is the most teams they've had ever for a Women's World Cup. So you're going to have a lot of games like this kind of going forward until other countries catch up. You know, this is the worry, not trying to go to the men's game, but this is kind of the worry with the men's game of opening up the World Cup to 48 teams. You know, where you get some teams in the World Cup that maybe shouldn't be there, but – you know, this is what FIFA wants to do. FIFA, you know, their job is to make money. And I think that for the elite teams, they look at it and say, okay, USA won 13-0. But, you know, when the USA plays France, England, or the other strong teams, the games aren't going to be like that. You know, they're going to be closer games, you know, 2-1, 3-0, those type of games. You know, we won't see as many goals when the U.S. plays better teams.
We've seen a lot of headlines, a lot of opinions about the U.S. maybe going too far in the amount of goals and their celebrations late in the game. I argued in our first segment that they're fighting for a lot more than just the trophy, and they're, you know, trying to get equal pay, and, you know, so they're really trying to represent and show what they can do at the fullest level. Do you feel like Team USA went too far in their celebrations with a 13-goal win?
You know, everyone keeps talking about that, and I don't know, I find it interesting. I mean, these are world-class athletes at the highest level of soccer, and you know, maybe if you want to kind of say something, Alex Morgan scoring 5 goals, 6 celebrations are bad. But, you know, for some people, this scoring in a World Cup, I mean, it happens every 4 years. It's a big deal, you know. And then for the U.S., for them to get upset, I mean, I don't know. To me, I don't understand the argument. This is a competition. The professional athletes, even the ladies in Thailand are professional athletes too. So, you know, for the U.S., I mean, if you win 13-0, you win 13-0. And for Thailand, I mean, I would love to know what their thoughts are on it. You know, if those players are offended by it, or if they're sitting there saying that, hey, we should have played better so the USA doesn't celebrate, right? So, you know, I think more or less on the competitive side, I look at it as, you know, USA winning 13-0 is awesome. It's really cool that happened. But I'm sure the ladies on the U.S. would want to play tougher teams. You know, playing a team like Thailand, it's fun, right? But you don't want games like that every single time. So I'm sure the U.S. is looking forward to taking on Chile in the next game and then taking on Sweden, which that would actually be a very good game for the U.S. to really kind of test where their capabilities are at. So I think for the U.S., you know, hey, 1-13-0, they have the celebrations, and, you know, this is the new cycle. It will change within next week, and it is what it is, right? So Everyone's always going to find something wrong if you beat someone 13-0. There's always something going to be said.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Chile and Sweden, the U.S.'s next two opponents. Just help us preview Group F a little bit and what that, you know, fans can expect when watching these three or four teams go head-to-head.
Well, so the interesting thing about the U.S. group is the U.S. should take care of business against Chile. That shouldn't be a problem at all. Sweden, that's going to offer an actually really good test for the U.S. But the interesting thing about this Group F is if the U.S. wins Group F, then they win their first knockout round match. They will face, and if France wins out too, the U.S. will face France in the quarterfinals. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, it's not like you want to say, hey, U.S., you know, let Sweden win the group. You don't want to say that, right? But the last time the USA played France, France defeated them earlier this year 3-1. So the U.S., you want them to win the group, but if France wins out too, both nations are going to be on the collision courts for what probably will be the World Cup final, even though it's the quarterfinals. I mean, France is, after the U.S., I'd say France is probably the second favorite, maybe third. But, you know, for the U.S., you know, if they went out on Group F, I mean, they're going to be facing potentially France in the quarterfinals. It would be a really, really good match.
Two Arizonans on this team, and Julie Ertz and Jessica McDonald, just for those fans that want to have that Arizona tie. Julie Ertz, a bit more of a household name, but what can you tell us about those players for anyone that wants to, you know, root for State 48?
Well, it's really cool that we have two Arizona natives, like you just said, on the roster. You know, in the last World Cup in 2015, Julie Ertz was on that roster. And so was Sydney Leroux. Now, Sydney is not a true Arizona native, but she did move out here in high school, and she played for Sereno back in the day when she was out here in Arizona. So we had two players in the last World Cup with ties to Arizona, but this is the first one we've had two players with Arizona, full Arizona natives, you know, born out here, grew up out here, played club out here. But Julie Ertz, I mean, everyone should know who she is. I mean, she was destined for stardom when she captained the U-20 women's team to a World Cup win back in 2012. So, you know, for Julie, everyone knew that she was going to be a complete stud for the U.S. women's national team. The really cool story, though, is Jessica McDonald. Now, here's a lady who was never on the national team radar at all. Interesting stat is there's 23 players currently on the U.S. women's roster. Out of those 23, 22 of them represented the U.S., at an international level, wherever, you know, whatever age, before the age of 23. Jessica McDonald was the only one ever to represent the U.S. before the age of 23. So, I mean, it's a really awesome testament to her, and it really shows that the athletes that, hey, man, you may not get looks now, but you continue to grind, you continue to work hard, and things will work out for you. I mean, Jessica McDonald is the third all-time leading goal scorer in the NWSL. She was the MVP in this past year's NWSL championship match, and it's a really cool thing for her. I mean, she's, like I said, a local kid, Cactus High School. I mean, she played at Phoenix College. You know, I think a lot of people think going to community college is a death sentence for athletic career. It's not. I mean, she went from Phoenix College to North Carolina. At that point, I think North Carolina had won 18 national championships at that point. So, you know, it shows to a lot of kids out there that just because you're not getting looked at D1 schools, D2 schools, that, you know, the opportunities for you to still make it as a professional athlete at any sport are still there if you continue to work hard and really persist and really, you know, have the right mentality to kind of go forward. So it's really awesome to see Jessica McDonald on the roster. I mean, it would have been nice if Jellis put her in against Thailand. I mean, that was a thrashing. So, you know, but we'll keep our fingers crossed that hopefully Jessica McDonald will get to see some minutes at the World Cup. It'd be a really cool story if she does.
Talking to Garrett Cleverly of the Arizona Soccer Association. So, you know, the soccer scene, I know I've known you for quite a while. I know that you Yes. know this soccer scene very well here in Arizona. Having those two players on Team USA, just what does that do for Arizona as a soccer state?
Well, I hope, as a soccer state, I think it just, you know, continues to show that Arizona produces players. And I'm actually out right now at watching soccer matches right now in Norco, California. It's President's Cup Regionals for Arizona teams. It's all the teams in the West Coast region are out here competing. We have 22 teams from Arizona competing in this tournament here. And the next week, actually, there's another regional tournament that will be held in Boise, and we have about 20 teams going to that. So, you know, I think for a lot of these kids growing up out here, is they can actually see something that's tangible. They can see something that's the reality. You know, when I grew up out in Arizona, I mean, I went to Sanchez matches at America West Arena way back in the day. I mean, that was the only exposure to soccer I had. And, you know, he had the World Cup every 4 years, and that was it, right? So I think for a lot of these kids, they get to see players like Julie Ertz, who is one of the faces of the U.S. Women's National Team, and even a player like Jessica McDonald. And then when these girls, I mean, the girls, when these ladies come back, you know, it's an opportunity for these kids to really interact with them. You know, that's why I think Phoenix Rising is so important to the Valley, is it shows kids that there is a pathway. It shows kids that there is an opportunity to play professional. And it's right here. I mean, they get to go to the games. They get to interact with the players. They get to do all those things. And you know, for some of the kids, you know, it really helps them out on their path. It really gets to provide an opportunity for them to see what the professional level is really at. So, you know, having players in the World Cup, it's huge. I mean, Arizona's produced a lot of players for the World Cup. You know, you go back to 2002 and 2006, you had Pablo Mascherini. He was part of the men's World Cup. And then 2010, you had Robbie Finley. He was part of the World Cup. You know, I mentioned Julie Ertz. She was with the U-20s. Now she's with the women. Richie Ledesma, another local kid. He was just with the U-20 World Cup in Poland that ended last week for the U.S. when they lost in the quarterfinals. So, you know, for Arizona, it just shows that we continue to produce athletes, even though we're not a true soccer state. You know, I'd say that at this point we're a football state first, probably baseball second. But, you know, soccer, we do provide, we do produce, you know, players for the national team and for professional levels. And it's great for the kids to see all that stuff, that, that one day that, hey, the same field that you're playing on, Julie Hurts and Jessica McDonald also played on those fields, and one day maybe you could be on the national team.
You said yourself you're in California right now watching some of the top talent in Arizona. We talked about the professional level a bit, but on the high school and college level, just how do you think Arizona is producing talent to get players to the next level currently, and how they stack up against some other maybe elite states?
Well, I mean, California South is just a beat. I mean, California is so big. They're split into two regions on the east side, but they're California South is massive. I mean, they always do well, but for Arizona, it's always a good test to play better teams to kind of see where we're at. You know, as far as, you know, producing talent, I mean, that a lot of that goes to the individual coaches. A lot of that goes to the individual clubs. You know, we have there's over 75 youth clubs throughout the state of Arizona. You know, that's not just Phoenix. That's Phoenix, Tucson, Flagstaff, Fresno, I mean, Havasu, Sierra Vista. I mean, it's crazy where all these kids come from. But, I mean, it really goes down to producing players. I mean, one guy that I spoke to, Luis Robles, he's the goalkeeper for the New York Red Bulls. I mean, he's from Sierra Vista. I mean, a guy from Sierra Vista has been the starting goalkeeper for the New York Red Bulls the last 6-7 years. He was the goalkeeper of the year, I believe, in 2015. And he goes back and credits Wolfgang Weber, who's a Tucson Legends soccer coach back in the day. I mean, he's still around. So I think it really comes down to producing the players. Now, it'd be nice if all of our players you go to the college level, stay in state. Obviously, I know a lot of kids want to go out of state for college for, you know, academic reasons, or they just want to get out of state. But, you know, when you look at Arizona, you know, having GCU as the Division I men's, that's huge for us. I mean, GCU's done really well. And the other thing, too, is that Arizona has one of the strongest community college levels for soccer in the entire country. Some of the programs are really well run. Phoenix College Men's, Yavapai, Paradise Valley Community College has won a couple of national championships on the women's side, Pima. They won a national championship. So the one good thing for Arizona is there is a pathway for a lot of players. And like I said, I mean, a lot of people kind of look at that community college level as like, I'm not going to go there. That's a lower tier. And maybe, but it's an opportunity to jump to that next level. And there's tons of players who go to the community college level here in Arizona that eventually make it to Division I programs and make it to professional ranks. There's a lot of them. I mean, I can start listing players left and right, but there are a lot of players that people want to look it up.
Garrett, we appreciate the time and the insight. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Jordan.
All right, that was Garrett Cleverly of Arizona Soccer Association, a guy that's just been super tapped in. Like I said, we actually grew up going to church together, and that's where I first met him. And he was definitely all in on soccer at a very young age, so he knows the scene very well. And as you can see, he knows certainly the international scene as well with what's going on with the Women's World Cup. Coming up next, we're going to talk more about the NBA Finals and where, you know, Kevin Durant potentially should go. What does this injury mean for not only this series but beyond that? And we'll get into the Diamondbacks a little bit more before getting with Jonah Carey of The Athletic. That's coming up next on the Brad Sessmat Show. Diamondbacks and MLB going. College World Series is making its way through as we approach Omaha. The Women's College World Series just wrapped up, and of course the NBA Finals. NFL is starting to, you know, you're starting to see rookies for the first time, for the first couple of weeks, actually. But with these finals, what's been really interesting is just the dynamic of Kevin Durant and how a couple days ago he was viewed as the guy that was kind of checked out. And now that he came back and played, got hurt, there's that gruesome video of his leg just giving. You know, I think that adds to the narrative as well. All of a sudden, people are looking around and being like, okay, maybe he was really hurt. Yeah, guys, he was. Doctors wouldn't clear him until a couple of days ago. And even though he was cleared, it was clear he wasn't ready to play. And now the dynamic has shifted from Kevin Durant already looking at his next destination, are, you know, already checked out with the Warriors. Yeah, that part of that might be true. No one really knows that except for Kevin Durant. But now it's very clear that he was truly not ready to play. And there are some people still hanging on to why Kawhi Leonard, you know, his injured sit out last year with the Spurs that got him traded. Now I tend to believe that Kawhi was probably onto something. He wasn't playing that great when he actually did play for the Spurs. I don't think it's because he was checked out. I think it's because he is the only one that knows his body, truly. And that, I don't know if there were misdiagnoses. I don't know if the Spurs were trying to rush him back, all that stuff. But ultimately, you don't know with injuries unless you're the player. These training staffs can do all they can. And the Phoenix Suns, for many years, has had one of the best in the business in Aaron Nelson, his staff. He brought so many people back. And the second they left, all of a sudden you saw them get injury trouble, whether it was Steve Nash, Grant Hill, Shaq. All those guys were relatively pretty healthy when they were here. I don't know what magic he had going, but he did. But even him, he doesn't truly know where a guy's at, what's going on in his head, unless he's the player. And so that shift is so interesting. And I feel for Kevin Durant because now, depending on what the injury was, it sounds pretty darn serious. I'm not going to go ahead and diagnose it, but it sounds like there's a chance he could be out. It's an Achilles injury. We don't know exactly what it is. I will say this, when a calf kind of gives like that, that is probably significant, and he's going to miss a significant amount of time. Now, everyone perceived he had the player option. He was going to opt out of that. So that's a domino that's going to fall. Does he opt back in for $30 million and just rehab with the Warriors as they pay him? I've also seen maybe Bob Myers has Kevin Durant opt out and then sign a max deal. So he sticks around with the Warriors. Everyone was thinking, all right, Durant may be, it might be a done deal. He's already a New York Knick. He could be a Brooklyn Net. Now all of a sudden there's a big shift, and there's one less elite player out there. One less big fish that an NBA franchise can go after. Brooklyn just gave away quite a few assets to clear a second contract. Can they still make all of that work and bring in a guy like Kyrie Irving, Anthony Davis? Maybe, you know, Kevin Durant's 30 right now. If I'm a team that's competing, I may still just go all in with that guy. Give him a max deal. Hope for the best moving forward. Because if things work out, you have the most talented player on the planet, if not top three. But if that doesn't happen, yeah, you're setting yourself up for some issues. But this is going to be so interesting how various teams do this, and it's going to be up to Durant. If Durant opts in with the Warriors, all right, now we prolong what could be maybe the best NBA offseason, this upcoming offseason. One less of those top players is out there, the top player out there. That could affect Kawhi. That could affect Kyrie Irving. You know, all these teams, you go down the list, Kemba Walker, Jimmy Butler, you know, all of these guys, D'Angelo Russell. You want to be paired on a super team. But there's only so many resources going on that are available. So the Warriors, they could potentially extend this dynasty with a plus 30 Kevin Durant, and Steph Curry. Draymond only has one more year. Klay Thompson, we don't know what he's going to do. Is he fine being the third or fourth guy mentioned on a team of just the best basketball players on the talent, or does he want to go be the guy? Not a lot of people are able to handle that, to go be the third person when really you're a top 15 player. I remember Sean Marion struggling with that, and he left and wanted to go be the number one. and he was the number one on some pretty average basketball teams. Yeah, he got to the postseason quite a few times, found a nice role, but he wasn't the number one guy. I believe when he won that championship with the, I think, the Mavericks, that team had Dirk. You know, I think Marion was probably the two or three, the role that he had on the Suns. So just going to be an interesting dynamic moving forward. How does all of this shake out? Could this affect the Suns? I know that they've been linked to a lot of being that third team in a big trade for Anthony Davis. Now, all of a sudden, does that shift the teams pursuing Anthony Davis? There's an article that just came out about Rich Paul, about, you know, how he's kind of navigating the offseason. And he went out and said, Boston Celtics, yeah, they can trade for him. They're going to get Anthony Davis for 1 year. So there's just so many fascinating things going on that's away from the court right now. And it's been a pretty darn good series, which is the crazy part. Right now, 3-2 with the Raptors. I have a feeling that Game 6, Warriors are going to win this. They're going to have an outsider's moment. What is it, Matt Dillon? The do it for Johnny, do it for Durant. They're going to have that moment. And then all of a sudden, it's Game 7 in Toronto. Craziness all around. Now, with Arizona Diamondbacks, won a tough one last night, 7-4. And as I was watching that game, one of the things that kept popping up in my head was this team last year, this team 2 years ago, wins that game. This year, you have a lot of rookies playing, and you're going to have rookie mistakes, and that's okay. You need to grow. A lot of these guys have already shown why they belong. Kevin Crone, when he hits the ball to another zip code and is hitting it at a pretty decent rate, he has shown he belongs. John Duplantier, for a long time, has been the top-rated pitcher in the Diamondback system, sometimes the top-rated player in the Diamondback system. He's been pretty good. He got knocked around by a good first-place team. But the difference was, as we were watching this game, Phillies get out ahead 3-0. Duplantier is struggling. TJ McFarland comes in. Now, if this was the last 2 years, TJ McFarland probably goes 3 scoreless, gets you to about the 6th inning, and then you're hitting the strength of your bullpen. You're hitting Yoshi. You're hitting Archie Bradley. Last year, you're hitting Brad Boxberger. Now you have Greg Holland. Holland's been very good. But the Diamondbacks aren't quite equipped that way right now. McFarland struggled again. He's still trying to find himself, and I still think could be a very good asset for the Diamondbacks or potentially another team if the Diamondbacks decide to become a bit of sellers. I don't think it's going to be that black and white, and we're going to talk to Jonah Carey about that. What do they do 6 weeks from now, roughly? Because right now, some people are calling it no man's land. I don't think it's that black and white. I think if there's a deal that makes sense, Mike Hazen is going to do it. But he's not going to do the fire sale and just ship off Zach Greinke and ship off Robbie Ray for pennies on the dollar. He still has a contract control for a little bit, at least Zach Greinke, and B, there's not an urgency here to just go move on and get something. And it was really interesting in this podcast that I just listened to with Jonah Carey and Jared Porter, the Arizona Diamondbacks assistant GM. That was one thing he said about the Paul Goldschmidt deal. They didn't feel like they had to make a deal. Now, I feel like the perception from the outside might have been, look, they took what they could get. That's about it. Diamondbacks could have still held on to Paul Goldschmidt up until roughly 6 weeks from now and try to drive up the market, try to go get a, you know, hope that he is having a good first half. He's doing okay in St. Louis right now. But they decided to make the deal when they did because they felt like they couldn't get a better deal with Carson Kelly, Luke Weaver, Andy Young, and a draft pick. Now, so far, yes, Luke Weaver is hurt, but he was a pretty solid number two for you in that rotation so far. And another thing that Jared Porter mentioned was, look, if we made this deal this time a year prior, they probably couldn't have gotten Weaver. because he was coming off his breakout season, his up-and-coming season. Carson Kelly was the top-rated player in the Cardinals system. And both of them kind of had down years. So it was the timing of it that worked well for them. And so far, I think when you look at what Carson Kelly has been able to do behind the plate, threw out Bryce Harper last night, looks like he has a good handle on managing the rotation as a young player. You're just not going to play when you're a catcher on the Cardinals not named Yadi Molina. That was his biggest issue, is reps. He's been so good that when you... he's been able to make Mike Hazen and Torey Lovello change their overall catcher philosophy for as long as they've been in Arizona. They like bringing on three catchers. But because Carson Kelly has been playing so well and hitting so well, they were able to mix it up. John Ryan Murphy is now in AAA, and it's just a two-catcher system. And that's crucial, I feel like, for the Diamondbacks moving forward, because now you can get, right now they're hurt. A lot of guys are hurt. But if you can get them healthier, you can bring an extra arm in that bullpen, which has been very average this year, and have one more weapon. You can have Taylor Clark up here more consistently. You can have John Duplantier up here more consistently, especially as the rotation starts to fill out with the veterans. If Taijuan Walker comes back, whenever that may be, Luke Weaver comes back, whenever that may be. Look, that may not be for a while, but all of a sudden you have a little bit of depth in the bullpen because of how well Carson Kelly has played. Offensively, he's top 10 among catchers right now with like 125 minimum plate appearances. He had a couple of base knocks last night, threw out Bryce Harper. You have control of him for a while with his contract. And by all accounts, he's been great in the clubhouse. And Luke Weaver has been a solid up-and-coming arm for you. And if he's back soon, all of a sudden this is a shot in the arm. You get Jake Lamb back, you get Luke Weaver back, you don't really have to make a trade, and you feel like your ball club has already improved. So just a lot of variables going on right now. But last night, I felt like Diamondbacks... you get TJ McFarland in, he bridges that game. Kevin Crone comes up with multiple guys in scoring position when two outs, strikes out, tough at bat. Eduardo Escobar hits a ball 349 feet when he needed 351 to get it out. All of a sudden, that's a completely different ball game. There's a rough relay in where they overthrew the relay man, and the Phillies were making the turn. An extra runner was going to come in to score a run. Kevin Crone was right there. Delivered a poor throw. The rookies showed yesterday. I think the inexperience a little bit showed yesterday. We haven't seen a ton of that. Overall, when you think of Duplantier, Merrill Kelly, who's a rookie, Taylor Clark, Kevin Crone, Christian Walker in his first expanded role, they've been pretty darn good. And they're going to have their ups and downs when it's a 162-game season. But this just felt like you're playing a first-place team on the road. You got in a home run battle with them the night before, a slow game. You set the record for most home runs in a ball game. And then you just kind of drop out following day. Like that's all I'm going to chalk that game up to. A couple of things that were rough, but you move on from it. Now Merrill Kelly is taking the hill today. Diamondbacks are still in the hunt, and that's the interesting thing to me. That it seems so up and down, and depending on who you ask, based on how a series went, it's either like, all right, pack it all up. Let's just sell all the assets, bring it down to the studs, whatever you need. And then they go to Toronto and get a sweep against a pretty bad Toronto team, but they're mashing the ball. And then it's, all right, let's go get a veteran arm. Let's go try to get Mike Leake. That deal supposedly already fell through, but let's go get a veteran starter. Let's go get another arm. we can, you know, make a push. And that's the thing. They're going to hang around. I think they're going to, and that's what I said at the beginning of the year. I said that they were going to hang around, be in striking distance, and that's where they are right now. They're three games out of the wild card. They're in third place. They're nine games behind the Dodgers. But let's face it, no one's going to catch the Dodgers. And they're in the thick of it with another very young, inexperienced Padre team. And a Rocky team that has been pretty solid but played inconsistently. And frankly, the Rockies should probably be more out of it because they've stolen a couple games from the Diamondbacks. This is a very different dynamic if the Diamondbacks don't blow, what, three games at Coors? And again, this is still June, middle of June. We have plenty of time to figure some things out. But I think where the Diamondbacks are right now, you have to be happy. Zach Greinke's pitching the most like an ace, the most like a guy who makes $32 million a year. And every time he gives up a home run, someone's going to mention that number. But he hasn't been worth that number at times with the Diamondbacks. This year he has. He has been your ace and dominated. Robbie Ray has quietly had a good, very good year. His issue is just getting deep in the ballgame. If he starts throwing 6-7 innings and it's not as taxing on the bullpen, all of a sudden, Diamondbacks are going to be in business. So, but in a tough, wide-open division, it's going to be interesting to see how they navigate the rest of this. But they're wrapping this up against the Phillies here tonight. Merrill Kelly taking the hill. And another guy that just has just peppered the strike zone, done a really nice job. So it's been a fun MLB year. I love that the Padres have been competitive. I love that the Twins are back in it and just playing lights out baseball right now. And pitchforks may come out, but the Dodgers are super fun to watch. You have probably the MVP in Cody Bellinger. You have all of these pitchers that are just clicking, and Dave Roberts can make no wrong move. Kike Hernandez, just get that guy his own reality show, because that dude's hilarious. It's just clicking. Something feels different with them, and that's something I'm going to talk to you with Jonah Carey coming up next. Is something feels different with this team, and it's not, I don't think anyone would be surprised to see them in the World Series. I feel like this could be the year they finally get over that hump. Coming up next, we have Jonah Carey of The Athletic. We're going to deep dive into some more baseball, probably nerd out on baseball. So that's coming up next on the Brad Sesmat Show. If you are a baseball fan, then you definitely need to check out The Athletic if you haven't already. Writers like Ken Rosenthal, Jason Stark, locally covering the Diamondbacks. Zach Buchanan does a great job. And also this guy, Jonah Carey, produces some great content in written form and in podcast. He has the Opener podcast and also his weekly 30, which power ranks every MLB team in the league. Jonah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So with the Diamondbacks, it's been a very busy offseason. A lot of moves, you know, some key contributors moving on from those playoff runs. When you saw the way the team has performed in the first third of the season versus your expectations, how have those differed?
Yeah, slightly beating expectations. I didn't think the Diamondbacks would be a terrible team this year, per se, but obviously the loss of Paul Goldschmidt in particular, that's a franchise player, you know, MVP caliber hitter typically, that's a huge loss. And to replace him would have been difficult, you would imagine. But they've been able to get it done in multiple ways. First of all, Christian Walker playing first base has really made a big difference. You know, they've been able to at least find somebody who can make up some of the lost performance, like in 476, having a pretty good season, 11 home runs. But you look at the steps up that some existing performers have taken, in particular Eduardo Escobar and Ketel Marte. These are breakout seasons for both of those guys, both sitting on 17 bombs, doing great things, and doing it from positions that aren't traditionally necessarily huge power positions. These are places where you put your best defensive players. Escobar's the third baseman. Marte plays center field and middle infield. And yet these guys have been producing in a big way. They lead the team by far and wins above replacement and have been really, really good. So, I mean, you put all that together along with, you know, the usual good stuff from Zach Greinke, some good performances here and there in the rest of the roster. And, you know, it's a team that has mildly surprised, I would say, so far this season.
Oh, you had a podcast with Jared Porter that you put out about a month ago, recorded it with him in March, the assistant D-backs general manager. And one of the interesting things that jumped out to me within that was him discussing how they've really fleshed out their mental skills department and really trying to focus on the mental side, not only on the field, but in everyday life. You've been covering baseball for a long time. Just how has the view on mental health and mental skills changed from when you first started covering baseball?
Quite a bit. I mean, we just didn't hear very much about that at all. It seems like the guy who kind of popularized this in the new generation was Joe Madden. Worked with a guy named Ken Revizza, who's a sports psychologist. And Revizza since moved on to work for the Cubs. He's consulted. He's done all kinds of things. And the idea of, you know, dealing with the pressure of the moment, that it is difficult to step on the field, or forget all that. Forget just the on-field stuff. What happens if you just suffer from anxiety and can't figure out how to make that work on the baseball diamond? And it's been interesting to see steps taken to address all that. I had Michael Phelps on the podcast as well, the Olympian. Was a 28-time medalist, 23-time gold medalist, and he talked very openly about anxiety and depression and how it can really affect you, no matter what you do, whether you wait tables, whether you're an accountant, or whether you're a professional athlete or an Olympic athlete. And it's great to see the sports world addressing all of that. So, you know, this is a good sign, and it's not just that you've got one guy or gal now, it's that it's systemic. When you've got a mental skills department, that's more than just, okay, you went 0-for-4, go see Bob. It's, you know, let's try to pay attention to this the way that we would strength and conditioning, the way that we would nutrition, the way that we would anything else, because, you know, what does Yogi Berra say? That 50% of the game, or was it 90% of the game is half mental, something to that effect. That definitely holds true.
So with the Diamondbacks and the efforts they've made in that department, how unique is that to the league? Are other franchises trying to do this? Has other franchises already done this?
You're seeing it here and there on a piecemeal basis, but this is probably the most systemic way of doing it that I've seen, because the mental skills department is designed to carry you from the time that you're drafted to the time that you are hopefully an all-star at the major league level, and you just don't really see quite that extent in other teams. So Diamondbacks probably a little bit ahead of the curve just in terms of making it holistic throughout the organization and focusing on every level.
You also talked in depth with him about the Paul Goldschmidt trade and how difficult that was and what was required of them to go ahead and finally pull the trigger. When you look at the return that they got, headlined by Luke Weaver and Carson Kelly, Weaver's hurt right now, but what did you think of especially the major league players that came back in return and how they've helped the Diamondbacks?
Well, what I thought then and what has transpired since, maybe a little bit different perhaps. I will say that at the time, well, even if you go back a little further, when Goldschmidt was coming up on the end of the 2018 season, I wondered what was going to happen, because the old construct in baseball is, oh, well, when you've got only 1 year left till free agency, or even if you're traded at the deadline before free agency, you can only expect so much in a trade. But now what we're seeing is so many teams re-signing guys to extensions that it becomes, you know, a little bit more favorable in terms of the prospects you should expect to get back. And in the Cardinals' case, they traded for Paul Goldschmidt. They immediately signed him to an extension because players aren't necessarily dying to go out and test free agency. Then unless you're Manny Machado or Bryce Harper, you might be disappointed. Now, whether Goldschmidt felt he was going to be disappointed, whether he thought it was a good fit with St. Louis, what have you, the fact of the matter is that one would imagine that the Diamondbacks came into that situation with the possible trade saying, okay, you're not just getting 1 year of service time, you're getting an exclusive window where you can negotiate with this guy and potentially keep him long term. And as we mentioned, Goldschmidt is a franchise type of player. So, you know, getting Kelly and Weaver, a pretty strong return, and it's been, you know, manifest in terms of the season they're playing very well. Now, Weaver, of course, goes down with a significant injury, as we mentioned. But Carson Kelly's a building block here. I mean, he's got, what, six-plus years of service time, or he'll have 6 years of service time to control within the Diamondbacks organization. He's slugging over .500. He plays a premium position, obviously, behind the plate. It's somebody that you can build around. And all of a sudden, the Diamondbacks are, you know, relatively young team. Escobar's under 30, Marte, Kelly, guys like that. There's some talent there. Obviously, they're getting contributions, no question, from the Greinke's and Adam Jones, and there's older players on the roster too. But it's a nice little coup to be able to trade somebody like Goldschmidt, get major league ready players in return, but they're also younger players, so that, you know, when Goldschmidt is starting to age out a little bit, these guys could just be coming into their own.
Looking at the National League West, obviously the Dodgers running away with the division right now, but there are three teams kind of bunched together in striking distance of the wild card in the Diamondbacks, Rockies, and Padres. Just what do you think is going to be kind of the X factor for those three teams as they try to make that playoff push later in the year?
Yeah, I mean, the Rockies need to take their home results and transport it to the road. They've won 10 games in a row at home, and they're playing just dynamite ball over there, and then they just get on the road, and offensively, certainly they suffer. But just overall as a team, they just don't play as well, you know, and even if you account for the normal gap between home and road that you see within baseball, you know, this is a step further than that. So you'd want to see, if you're a Rockies fan anyway, you'd want to see the Rockies playing better on the road. You know, as for the Padres, they've got some questions here because some of their younger pitchers, what are you going to do with them? Like, let's take a guy like Chris Paddock, who's been a great pitcher for the Padres. This is his rookie season. So what do you do if the Padres are in the race come July? Paddock's sitting at 110 innings or something like that by that point in the season, and he's really never gone deep in terms of innings count and pitch counts and so forth. You're going to have to ask questions. So if the Padres want to stay in the race, it might behoove them to go out and get starting pitching. I thought that Dallas Keuchel would have been a great fit for them, actually, because here's somebody who has been fresh, can give you as many innings as you want, and can supplement some of those young guys that you have in the rotation. And as for the Diamondbacks, yeah, I think it's a matter of acquisitions, really. They're missing a few pieces, potentially. They could potentially use a little bit of help, possibly in the outfield. You know, if Jerrod Dyson, if you don't feel that he's necessarily an everyday player, and he's cooled off quite a bit, doesn't offer any power, things like that. And obviously pitching, you know, is always going to be something, the loss of Weaver, if they want to try to cover up for that, and they consider themselves contenders, then there's a good opportunity there to acquire somebody who can slot in behind Greinke. Getting a really effective number two starter would certainly go a long way to helping the Diamondbacks.
So if the Diamondbacks are kind of keeping pace as we approach the trade deadline, I don't think it's as black and white as a buyer and a seller. I think if a deal makes sense for Mike Hazen, he's going to do it. But just how much do you think the roster could change if they do keep this pace where they are in striking distance of the wild card?
Yeah, it might maybe not all that much, exactly, because they are in that sort of no man's land where they are contenders, but they're contenders probably for wild card just because the Dodgers are so good, and the Dodgers are very much most likely going to win the division. So the question becomes, what do you do with the rest of the roster? You're not trading Greinke because you don't want to do something like that when you're still in the race. You're not putting up a white flag necessarily. And then you don't want to trade any of your young guys, your core players. You're not trading Escobar. You're not trading Marte. You're not trading players like that. So I think it could be on the margins where it could be an addition, you know, that makes sense. You know, maybe you're going, you go pick on a team like the Blue Jays or the Orioles or the Marlins. And you say, okay, you've got guy X. We could use that player. You're not going to contend for a couple of years now. What can we do to make a trade? But I don't think you see them strip mining the farm system for buying purposes, and I don't necessarily think you see big sales either. I think the Diamondbacks could be one of the quieter teams at the deadline just based on kind of the middle-of-the-road position that they're in.
Jonah, we appreciate the time and the insight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That is Jonah Carey of The Athletic. He does a little bit of everything. A great writer, puts out a lot of content in the written form also via podcast. You can check out The 30 every Monday, where he power ranks the entire league. He alternates between NL and AL teams, where he goes in depth on kind of where they're at, and also has quite a few really good podcast guests, including Jared Porter from a couple weeks ago. And I suggest you guys check that out if you're a Diamondbacks fan, because he has an interesting background, and the Diamondbacks are certainly doing unique things. So be sure to check that out. So special thanks to Jonah Carey, as well as Garrett Cleverly. I don't know why I have stumbled over his name like three times a day. Garrett Cleverly, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to Kennedy Wilkerson and Devin Henry on the other side of the glass for keeping us afloat. I'm Jordan Hamm. Have a great Wednesday.